Okay, so this is experimental for me, and this is a sheer topic that I myself am still exploring. I decided to come up with a catchy and edgy title, my Esther Founder voice on feminism, nationalism, and the search for personal identity. Sounds interesting. I barely know what that means. So, but I sound smart. Anyhow, what I'd like to do is to share something that has shades of things that I've thought about in the past, shades of ideas that are new. I look forward, though, to your input as we we learn. I'll give a talk, a lecture, but also a conversation, because I think that there's a lot here to be thinking about, especially, as you'll see, in the era of Me Too. Most of what we're going to be doing is basically just looking at text from the Megillah. There are so many commentaries we could be looking at, but I want to focus our energies with the limited amount of time that we have on Megillah itself, and I look forward to doing that. Before we jump into the Megillah, though, I want to share some background with which I think we're familiar, but to kind of open the conversation in a particular kind of way. You know, one of the classic observations about Megillat Esther is that there is an individual or an entity who or which is conspicuously absent from the Megillah. And of course, I refer to God, right? Because that was a subtle giveaway. But we're familiar with this insight. There doesn't seem to be, there's no sense of explicit divine intervention in the story. The Jews kind of do things in many ways on their own, whether it's Esther, Mordechai, the community as a whole, and so on and so forth. And one of the classic questions is, what does that signify? And we know that over the course of not just the Jewish tradition, but even the scholarly and academic tradition, look at different interpretations of the Megillah, a whole host of different explanations has been offered. Now, on one extreme, we have the explanation that suggests that, in fact, are you kidding me? Right? God's not there because, some would claim, that it was not initially, at least, written as a religious book, that Mordechai and Esther took on Gentile, how are you, took on Gentile names, that there was assimilation. Even the rabbis themselves said that the Jews simply went and partook from the non-kosher party of Achashverosh. There was no OU, there were no kosher catering options, right? And they went and they participated. And so some have gone to the extreme of suggesting that, in fact, the reason for God's absence is very simply that God was never written into the Megillah in the first place. That would be one extreme interpretation. Obviously, the rabbis generally did not endorse this view, but I would go further and I would suggest that actually that extreme formulation of it, that there's no sense of religiosity whatsoever in the Megillah, I think is difficult even on a textual basis. And I just wanted to point out that in sources numbers 1 and 2, that's both, 2 for the price of 1, we know that when the Jews hear about the decree, how do they respond? Now take a look at sources 1 and 2.
Yes.
Right? So, well, okay, Mordechai does this, lamenting thing, okay? So some would say that at least once upon a time this was very Jewish, right? Or as I've been told, it was very, it's very Ashkenazic, right? Very, okay, so, right? Or Litvish, or medieval, or whatever. Right? So Mordechai yadad kol asher nasa, vayikra Mordechai et bigadav, vayabash sak va'efer. Mordechai learned about what had happened, Haman's decree, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, he went through the city, cried out loudly, and cried out bitterly, right, so we know this. So this is already striking that he's dressing up in sackcloth, he's mourning now. It's possible that he's just a sad Jew, right? He heard, learned of the fate, and so he's embittered. So that's not 100% clear that it's religious in nature. But take a look at source number 2, right? Esther has now accepted the mantle. She's going to go in. She's going to go before the king, and she's going to stand before him, right? She's going to represent the Jewish people, despite all the risks that are involved in that. And what does it say? And what is she? What message does she send to Mordechai through her intermediary, through Hatach? Go and gather all the Jews who are found in Shushan. Vitzumu alai. fast on my behalf. Yatachul v'yateshu shoshim yayvayom. Gamani, whatever that means, right? To fast for 3 days, right? Literally, figuratively. Gamani v'narotayotzum kein. Uvachin aval amel chashelucha dach. Hasher avati, avati. By the way, in other faith traditions, like in Islam, there are some who... Right, who will drink, for example, through a fast day, through Ramadan and the like. You know, water would be permitted, something like that, right? I know some Jews who wouldn't mind that when it comes to Jewish fast days. I've heard that suggestion among others been offered in the past. But, right, so they go ahead and fast on my behalf. Now, God's name is absent, and I think that's significant. We're going to talk more about that, obviously. But it is kind of hard to my mind to understand this as anything but a religious. Mm-hmm. And what are they doing? And right, not only that, there are reasons to believe that they were even fasting on the day that they actually went out to war. That's actually ultimately to defend themselves. So, you know, they're fasting, they're gathering, etc. To say that this is an entirely, even just based on just the text itself, an entirely irreligious book that's not part of the background, I think is difficult.
So my question is, I hope this is an okay question. Where does this fall historically within the Tanakh, mm-hmm. within the rabbinic literature? Do we have any idea of like when this happened? When this is supposed to have happened?
Sure, and of course, still could ask. We do have a fairly good sense, but there's some debate around exactly the details. So essentially, this is according to modern scholarship questions the authenticity. Let's assume this is
right. Authenticity.
Yeah.
Historical context.
So modern scholarship and some Jewish scholars as well, or some religious scholars as well, assume that this takes place about 50 years following the construction of the Second Temple. There's another rabbinic voice that suggests that actually this took place between Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni, which is the more common view, but it doesn't necessarily seem historically to work as well, actually. And so you have a movement toward that direction. It actually has implications in terms of the meaning of the Megillah. Right? If the critique of the Jew, if the story is happening between the first and second temples, then the fact that the Jews are in Shushan, right, just like they're Jews in Babylonia, etc., right, in the far-flung reaches of the empire. By the way, Babylonia is now fallen, and now you have Persian Empire risen to the fore. You know, that's one thing. But if the Beis HaMikdash has been built, as Rabbi Menachem Liebtag has argued, and the Jews are busy partying at the fast in the great capital city of the empire, except the capital is no longer Jerusalem, it's not Yerushalayim, instead it's Shushan, then maybe this is an implicit sort of dig or critique of the Jews for finding themselves in one place or another. Others push back, actually, and have an opposite interpretation. They say, we don't mean to idealize the existence of exilic Jewish communities, but actually, this is a story that for all the Jews' shortcomings, they managed to rise to the occasion, right? They found themselves under threat of genocide, and you have a heroine who rises to the occasion. Mordechai emerges as the leader of the Jewish people. They take arms in their own self-defense. They eventually emerge, if not in a perfect situation, in a vastly improved one, to say the very least. You know, so it's not necessarily to say that this is the ideal Jewish community, but that there can be meaningful, you know, sort of experience for a non-Israel-based Jewish community as well. And so, you know, depending on where you are on the Zionist spectrum, you tend to argue about this with your peers. You know, it's kind of hard to separate your, you know, your political persuasions from your, reading of the Megillah. But that'll situate us a little bit.
Take biblical period. Either between the two temples or after the second temple.
That's right. Right toward the very end of Tanakh. And that's there's also some historical debate exactly when the second Beis HaMikdash was built. So either we're talking about, according to classical rabbinical chronology, we're talking about 350 BCE roughly. Mm-hmm. Thereabouts, if you talk about the more... the more widely academically accepted in some religious circles as well, they'll push it up to something like 428, roughly, B.C.
That's really helpful.
Yeah, my pleasure. So that's one extreme interpretation, the absence of God's name. Of course, in the rabbinic tradition, there's a recognition that Hashem's name is absent, but nonetheless, a sort of a playing up of of God's presence, but sort of right behind the scenes, right? So you have a lot of classic interpretations. I gave you just one in Source 3. Right? This, just like in Source 1, is read in a mournful voice, right, by the Baal Kriya, right? Mordechai yadav kosher nasa, vayikra Mordechai yad pigadav, right? So it's an echa tune. It's a mournful tune. So too, there's a special tune that many Baalei Kriya use for the beginning of the sixth chapter, except this is more of sort of either mysterious or just a different kind of, or even triumphalist, a kind of trumpeting almost, a kind of tune. Balayla hahu Adida Shnata Melech, right? So maybe even Yom Narayim type. And check it out, your local Megillah reading, RVB, and see what you hear and if you hear. But I think there's a certain almost tactile nature, not physically, not tactile, but almost in an oral sense, of the way the Megillah is read. And I think this is an instance thereof, and this is based on the rabbinic tradition that, of course, it's a capital Hey HaMelech, as it were. That's a reference to the Ribono Shel Olam. There are other allusions to God's presence that the rabbis derive from the Megillah. So that's sort of the opposite interpretation, is to see this as sort of a way of really, excuse me, of sort of saying, well, just because you don't see God as manifest, it doesn't mean that he's not behind the scenes, you know, pulling the strings and all the marionettes and running the show, in fact. And actually, sometimes there are explicit miracles in Jewish history, and other times there are God, you know, operating, and that's exactly how God operates in contemporary times. Just because we don't see him doesn't mean he's not present. Just because the Jews are off in Shushan, not in Yerushalayim, just because they don't have the Beis HaMikdash either there or it's not built at the time, wherever you take it, doesn't mean that God's not behind the scenes helping to run the show. Don't overestimate that. Don't overlook that. And as a sort of almost an opposite interpretation, it's not that God is not present. It's that he's intentionally behind the scenes, because that's actually what drives the entire story of the Megillah. What I'd like to suggest is sort of an in-between explanation, a third interpretation. And before I do that, though, I just want to make an observation that highlights the lack of presence of God in the Megillah. Because the truth is that we're not going to dwell on this, but it's worth noting, this could be a whole series of other shiurim and future occasions, but it's very interesting to note that when we take a look at the story of Esther and the Megillah, there are many biblical parallels. Many other stories in Tanakh that strikingly parallel the story of Esther. Anything that comes to mind? And there's so many answers.
Well, Yosef.
Right? Yosef is a classic answer. Let's unpack that.
So, a number of reasons. One, I think that Yosef was the first major Golot story where he really becomes part of the royal household.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Secondly is the whole thing of the sleepless king. Mm-hmm. You know? Looking and finding the answer in Yosef and in Mordechai, and in his description, Yifat Tawah, very much parallel to
Esther. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe. So it's even a textual set of parallels. Very good. And so that's one classic example, perhaps the closest of all the biblical stories. And what always struck me is that what's interesting is that on the one hand, God's presence there does not say at every single moment in that story either that Hashem, you know, led Yosef to do this and led Paro to do that, led Ishas Potiphar to this accusation, but, you know, God came to his rescue. But what's interesting is that nonetheless, what does Yosef go out of his way to do, both in the text and as amplified in the Midrashim?
Well, he always attributes everything that happens to God.
Right. So
even when he's talking to his brothers, I'm sorry.
Right, yeah, no, 100%. I was asking, putting it out there. Yeah, 100%. But Yosef's the one, after he interprets the dream successfully, and then they call him, right, remember, Yosef interprets the butler and the baker's dreams successfully in prison, and then he's forgotten for 2 years, and then Paro has his two mysterious dreams, and then the Sar HaMashkim, the butler, who had previously been in prison together with Yosef, says, I remember there was this Na'ar Ivri, there was this the Hebrew slave. They call him in. Yosef interprets the dreams for Paro. And how does Yosef explain himself? To whom, right? He says, explicitly, he says, well, that actually came from God. I think it's so striking. You have this parallel. between the story of Esther and the story of Yosef. Yosef being, as I think is correctly pointed out, the first court Jew, essentially, right? It's, right? There's a long history of those, until 2018, perhaps. Be that as it may, right? Okay, you can't. There are so many reasons you can't give this shir without political references one way or another. It's just not possible. But be that as it may, it's so interesting. There are all these similarities, and yet, the glaring difference to me is that Yosef explicitly is talking about the name of God, and yet Esther, through no fault of her own, as we'll see, as we know, hides her identity. Yosef is known as a Jew, Esther is not. And more to the point, for our purposes right now, Esther and God's name, Megillat Esther and God's name, are not present together, whereas according to Chazal, amplifying this theme, they say that Shem Shamayim Shagor Befiv, that it was Rashi quotes it on Chumash as well, that he was always talking about the name of God. And so this is just one example, and there are others as well. There are fewer but some significant parallels between this story and the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim generally. Right, that would be another one. Right, the notion of the attempted genocide clearly is part of this story, and there are a number of other similarities as well. And yet there also, even more so than the story of Yosef, what would we say about the presence of God? And pull up her chair. Or take this one. What would we say about the presence of God in that story? Right, in the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? If you were to pull out our 1 to 10 scale over here, okay, our official, right? Okay, right? By the way, when anyone asks the question on a scale from 1 to 10, or whatever, rarely is the answer anything between 1 and 10. Did you ever notice that? It's more times than not, it's an 11, but just, right? 10 plus is right. So, human nature. So, right. Anyhow, be that as it may, and the middle numbers don't, if you're going to choose something from 1 to 10, right, it's a 2 or it's a 9 often. Anyhow, you have, again, another story where there's some parallels, and yet there, God's name is everywhere, and that's the paradigmatic instance of an Eis Nigla, of an explicit miracle. And there's even another story in Tanakh, lesser known, but also strikingly similar, which is the story of Daniel. The book of Daniel is not oft studied for a number of very good reasons. Number one, it's written in abstruse Aramaic, much of it. That's almost, it's exceedingly difficult to understand. And number two, the latter half of the book is these mysterious visions that are incredibly exotic. And to talk about their meaning and the messianic predictions, and it's eschatological and it's all sorts of things. And it's also just tucked away in a corner of Tanakh that people just don't necessarily get to. And yet the beginning of Sefer Daniel, if you read through it, Hebrew, Aramaic, English, you'll see actually also Daniel is a court Jew and is working in you have the notion of someone who's working there, in that case, for Nebuchadnezzar, pouring wine for the king, and there are ambiguous dreams that need to be interpreted, and there's attempted persecution, and specifically the coerced bowing before an idol in that case. Right? And Haman. Right, it's very, very similar, and they get thrown in the fire, these three heroes, and they don't burn, so there's a miracle, and the miracle is, again, quite explicit. So what I mean to say, and also court Jews and all of that, so what I mean to say is that, the absence of God, I think, is underscored in many ways by the similarities between Megillat Esther and so many other stories in Tanakh, whether they be Yosef, whether it be Tzion, whether it be Daniel. And by the way, we haven't even touched on extra-biblical stories, like from the Apocrypha. There are a whole host of other ones, very similar stories, like Yehudit, very famous story that has some parallels in terms of the female heroine and so on and so forth. And yet, in all of these different stories, you have HaKadosh Baruch Hu amplified and present, Esther not. So the lack of name of God, I think, is really brought home by the fact that Esther is so similar to so many other stories, and yet. And so it really, I think it even heightens the question, okay, so where is God? So we said, well, one extreme interpretation is that he's just not present, but we said that doesn't work because his name is not actually mentioned, but there's clearly religiosity on the part of the Jews during the fasting. Well, the opposite extreme say, well, God is really present, he's driving everything from behind the scenes, and that's the rabbinic interpretation. I think it has some truth to it, but what I want to suggest is that in addition to that, I think really what the Megillah is trying to do is it's pointing us in a very particular direction. I think the Megillah is trying to point us in the direction of saying, of course Hashem has a role in all of this behind the scenes, but if you're only looking for the allusions to HaMelech, to God's role in bringing about this salvation, you've missed half, if not more, of the message that the Megillah is trying to convey. The Megillat Esther is not only a book about God and how he intervenes in history, it certainly is that, but it is at least as much a story about the human characters, about the protagonists themselves, especially the namesake of the book, Megillat Esther. And so I think it's almost as if the story itself is saying, yes, of course, think about divine providence, but also don't neglect to look at the story itself and to examine the evolution, the growth of its different characters. And I think in particular, I want to look today at Esther. Yeah.
By the way, I think that Yosef's story also shows his evolution, because from a certain point of view, one could surmise that he was very attentive to prison gossip in order to know which servant of the king was probably corrupt and probably more favored. So Yosef learns to listen in contrast to Esther, who learns to speak.
Good. So we're gonna come to Esther's sense of identity. I think that's great. And I think also Yosef grows in his self-awareness throughout the story. Remember, at the beginning, he doesn't recognize the ramifications of telling all of his older brothers, I'm going to lord over you, by the way, just one day. One day I'm going to be king and you're going to be the servant, right? And nonetheless, does that kind of person succeed in the house of Potiphar? Would that kind of person be the one who manages to be second to the king? You know, those kinds of people usually only do well as number one, right? If you want to be a number one, right? And that's how we are wired. And then you succeed as a number two. You've learned something along the way. So clearly Yosef in that position has managed to have the self-awareness to have those political ambitions and yet to somehow modify himself so that he's not perceived as a threat. So that's very striking as well. But yeah, there's an inversion, I think, that you're pointing to when you look at Esther. And what I want to do, and very often the evolution of Esther is indeed traced. And what we see is that Esther is initially passive, and then she becomes active. You can say this in Talmudic parlance. You can say, we're talking in the language of Gemara, we talk about someone, the difference between what we call a cheftza, which is Aramaic for an object, and a gavra, a gever, right? Or a person, right? So moving from an object to a subject. And clearly that sense of Esther finding her voice, as Emily said, is essential to the story. I've heard this year in many different variations. I heard one from Shani Tarragon, for example. I think she delivered, I want to say that, I think that was here at some point with her students. I once heard when she visited, she spoke around something along those lines and others as well. This is a common motif, and I want to trace that, but I want to trace it in a broader context. And this is what I want to suggest to add this year. And that's two pieces that I want to trace in the Megillah. I'm going to try to do this a little bit quickly. So hold on. Feel free to jump in with your comments, but hold on a little bit for the ride. And I want to look at a couple of different pieces in the story of the Megillah as part of this evolution. And I want to suggest a couple of things. To look at not only Esther's own growth, but also to take a look at number one, how her growth is intertwined with the theme of nationhood. Nationhood. I want to suggest that nationhood is a central motif in the Megillah in many profound sorts of ways and should cause us to think differently and more richly about Esther's own evolution as an individual. And I want to ask the question of Esther's locating herself as a member of a nation to what extent and how is that intertwined with her ability or her success in finding her voice as an individual? And that very often we think of those, in at least in 2018, as separate sorts of things, but I think actually the Megillah is making an implicit argument about the ways in which a sense of roots and a sense of identity of being rooted in a larger narrative or a larger peoplehood is actually intertwined with her sense of individuality. That's argument number one that I want to posit. And argument number two, that's a primary argument. And then secondarily, but what we'll start in terms of the story of the Megillah, is that this is not only a story about an individual, it's a story, I think, read at least through 2008 lenses, but I think it's authentic to the text as well, a story about a female rise to leadership in particular, in the year of 2018 and the Me Too movement and all of that, right? So I know these are sensitive issues, but I think that they're critically important. And I think reading Megillat Esther, and we'll only scratch the surface, I think there's a lot more to say, obviously. And I don't mean about the larger issues. I mean in terms of the Megillah itself. In other words, what I mean to do is to posit a thesis, but also to open up a larger conversation that I think we can extend beyond the shir about how Esther begins to open up the questions of someone who undergoes trauma, of someone who experiences what it means to be undergoes degradation, the kinds of psychological responses that this female individual finds for herself, and the kinds of ways in which she has the resilience to find her voice and to rise to levels of leadership that are striking. And I think there's a lot to say, and there are a lot of psychological insights that we can bring to bear on this, but I think that there's a depth and a profundity in all of this that I think will emerge. Now, what I do is to start to just take certain snippets from the Megillah and trace this whole story as I think it unfolds, and I think it unfolds from the beginning of the story. Number one, I didn't even give you this text, but Ahasuerus starts with the party, which seems like a little bit of a sideshow. Like, why is the whole first chapter even relevant to the Megillah, many of us? And I think that that's a great question to raise. If someone doesn't mind just closing, there are three windows that are open. They're alternating, so like 1, 3, 5. I think that'll help it a little bit. Just if you don't mind. Thank you so much. And they stopped just for us. Yes, perfect timing. They saw it. They got the hint. Right, so the whole first chapter, many of the Mefarshim have asked, who even needs the first parak of the Megillah? Like, what's that really all about? Right? It doesn't really tell the story. There's no Haman. There's no attempted persecution of the Jews. You don't have Mordechai. You don't have Esther. Right? None of them are introduced until Parak Bet. Why is any of this really relevant to anything that we're talking about over here? Right? But it's interesting to know that from the outset, whom does he invite to his party? The officers from every single nationality. And I think that that's striking. And I think that I want to suggest that the word Am, as we'll see, is not only important in terms of Am Yisrael, but I think that there's a larger theme, a motif of Am. In fact, I did some homework on this. The word Am appears, I believe, 35 times in Megillat Esther. 35 is a multiple of 7. Anytime you have a multiple of 7, that's usually a hint, a key that something essentially happening here. Also, the phraseology of Am Va'am, nation and nation, appears on many occasions, roughly 10, in Megillat Esther. I believe nowhere else in Tanakh, according to my handy-dandy concordance, or concordancia, as they call it in Israel. 35, I believe, for the word Am, and Am Va'am roughly 10 times, and that conjunction nowhere else, I believe, in the entirety of Tanakh, as best I can tell. That's one piece that's already in the background in terms of the notion of nationhood for the Jews and nationhood in general. Then you have to bring in the thread of personal identity and the treatment of women in the story. You have the story, of course, of Vashti. And that I gave you by Yom HaShvi, all right, Perak Aleph, Psukim Yud Yud Aleph, Source 4. By Yom HaShvi, Ketav Lev HaMelech Vayayin, Amar Lemhumam Zetach Harvona B'Ketav Atag Zetar V'Charkas, Shivat HaSarisim HaMisharitim Et Pnei HaMelech, right, etc. Achashir Shal Aviyad Vashi HaMalkav HaMelech, right, Becheter Machud Arod HaMeim Sermit Yofya, to show off her beauty, Kitavat Marehi. And I didn't give you the next pasuk, but you know, she refuses Vatimayin HaMalkav Vashti, and then they get rid of her. By the way, right, they get rid of her it never says explicitly in the Megillah that they say off with her head, yeah. Right? It could be that they kill her. It could be that they simply depose her, right? To me, though, right? Whatever it is, it's not entirely beside the point. It actually matters. But nonetheless, either way, she is being subject to clear-cut sexual abuse. There's no way around it. There's no alternative reading of this. His behavior is intolerable, and I want to say something about this. I grew up attending Jewish day schools and learning a couple of things about Vashti, which are in the Midrashim. And this needs to be researched further, right? So number one, the favorite is that?
Green.
Right? Green. And that she had a tail, right? I mean, if you grew up in Jewish day school, this I say, right? So this is, you know, the classic Rambam. Rambam says there are three ways of learning fantastical Midrashim. There are those who take them literally and therefore say throughout the whole tradition, right? Rambam didn't mince words. He says those are the heretics. Okay. Then the second people take the Midrashim literally, and these are the people I think he liked almost less, I suspect. Yeah. They take the Midrashim literally, and therefore they say, oh, the rabbis actually thought, he doesn't give the example of Vashti was green and had a tail, but you get the idea, right? The Rambam says they're not heretics, they're just a bunch of fools. Right. Again, I think he that was actually irked him at least at most. And then you have the people who take the fantastical Midrashim, not literally but seriously, and he says those are the only people you should pay attention to. And I want to add to what he said is that part of what happens sometimes, the challenge of growing up in Jewish day schools, if you're taught in a certain way, is that you have to do a lot of not just learning, but a lot of unlearning. And you know, it was interesting. I was talking to someone who did not grow up hearing this Midrashim and actually just learned about this for the first time. And the response was like, really? I said, wait, that's what they teach? And then and it was interesting. And I said to him, I have to be honest. Obviously, I feel blessed that I had a Jewish day school education. I wouldn't trade it in for anything. There's no question about that. But just on this one example, I think I would have turned out okay if I went without it. And I would have been able to look at this, you know, from a cleaner slate.
Which day school? What? Which day school
did you go to? Well, I don't want to impugn any particular day schools, I don't think this is quite.
I went to SAR.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. You didn't
learn this when my grandson, his father,
you didn't
bought him a book from
really?
Brooklyn,
uh-huh.
Purim,
right.
That was the first time I saw.
So
him.
I certainly don't want to, God forbid, name or impugn any particular day schools. That's not my point. But I would say this is, I think, I haven't done an official study, but I'm going on a limb suspecting that it's more the norm than it's not. That's just my wild.
It is.
Absolutely. I'm not. More Orthodox day schools teach children at some point in teaching the Purim story that Vashti had a tail and was green than not.
When somebody take that, I heard this come up in my shul. Someone asked a question. I thought, what are they talking about?
Right. Now you can teach this in different ways. You can teach it and say there's a difference between the Midrash and Pshat and so on and so forth. And then it's tough. It's developmentally, it's complex. And there's something exciting about hearing fantastical stories for young kids. And there's something that's lost, actually, a little bit when you tell them a fantastical story and you say, but, you know, we don't really mean it. So it's like, why did, you know, kind of you're bursting my bubble, right? And I'm a little young to have my bubbles burst. So it's, you know, it's hard for me to process also when I'm all of, you know, 6, 7 years old. It's not so simple. So either way, though, right? We also, there are rigorous midrashim that have her as the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, which from a Jewish perspective is not exactly a compliment, right? Her granddaughter, different versions of this midrash. You know, what's interesting, and this is not a shir on Vashti, but we could have a shir on Vashti, is there a sympathetic reading of her that's legitimate from a Jewish perspective? There's nothing that's negative that's said about her in the story of the Megillah, and she's subject to abuse, and not only that, but what does she do? Right, she says,
no.
Right, she says, I'm not coming. And you know what? She probably knows full well the consequences of that. And if she is put to death, right, then all the more so, she's willing to stand up and say, right, I think it's pretty impressive. So, again, not a shir on Vashti, but I do want to say, for our purposes, that already at the background, already at the outset of the Megillah, the question of how a woman responds to a situation of right, of sexual degradation becomes, I think, essential to the whole story. And in general, the notion of, am I passive, am I active? Am I, do I have a voice or do I have a voice? And Mordechai, by the way, I don't know if he evolves in the same way, but the leadership that he takes, the fact that despite or because of his leadership, he's Ratzui L'Rovechav, right? When the majority of the Jews like him, that's a whole other thing about rabbis, right? If the majority of people like you, you've succeeded, right? People laugh, right, about that, but it's, right? I don't laugh. It's, some of us live with that every day. But, right, in other words, Mordechai, the questions of leadership, I think, are all over the Megillah, and for others as well, right? I mean, there are questions about Ahasuerus, questions about Haman, there are questions even about tertiary characters. Charvona, V'gam Charvona, Zachor LaTov, hang Haman's 10 sons on the gallows, right? They're right over there. So questions of people finding their voices, having voices, and leadership in general, I think, is a larger question that Vashti in this whole story already raises to the fore. I think it's also fascinating that what's Ahasuerus' response? His advisors recommend that he not only depose Vashti and hold the pageant, but also that he distribute a letter to all of the husbands of the kingdom. Okay, and that's in source 6. Every province, every nation, every man should wield authority in his home and speak the language of his own people. Now, there's a political dimension to this, which, by the way, the Persian kings actually were quite benign in the sense that their strategy was not to impose a homogenized religious and cultural demand upon their different peoples, but to allow for relative freedom of worship. Cyrus, who at the beginning of the book of Ezra and Nehemiah famously proclaims that the Jews are invited to return and to rebuild the temple, it's the beginning of the Second Temple prophecy, is by design, as it were, a Persian king. We have archaeological evidence, something called now called the Cyrus Cylinder, which confirms that that was an intentional policy not only aimed at the Jews, but all of this religious and cultural freedom. So clearly part of what's happening here is that this is consistent with that Persian strategic approach of allowing for a certain degree of individuality. Everyone speaks his own tongue, that's true, but it's also Leo Kolish Sorer Beveto. I mean, it's very hard, you know, and it's hard to know when you're kind of like how to separate out the, like, I'm reading it through current lenses versus this was the initial pshat in the Megillah, but to me it's very hard to, you know, and it's as an outgrowth of what happened with Vashti. So I think Pshuto Shel Mikra is that this clamping down and saying, no, the men are running the households and that's how it's going to be in this place, and coming from Ahasuerus, given what he had done to Vashti, you know, I don't know if that paints him necessarily in a positive sort of light. So, you know, I think what emerges is that before Esther even comes on the scene, there's a lot of context, there's a lot of baggage in terms of this kind of mistreatment and the question of a woman who does have a voice or stand up for herself, and the question almost, will Esther and does Esther ultimately do the same, not only for herself as an individual, but for her people as well. And of course, that brings us to Esther, because Esther is introduced not as a primary character, but as a secondary character. The one who's primary, and this is a pasuk that we read out loud. Here it's not acted out by the Baal Koreh. Here it's actually read first by the community. There are four verses over the course of the Megillah which are read first by the Kahal and then by the reader. And this is the first. Perek Bet Pesukim Hei Devah. Vishud Yayab Yishushan Amira Ushmo. Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shemi Ben Kish Yishimini. He's got all the Yichos Asher Glam Yerushalayim. We're going to come back to this. There's the sense of the roots of his own history. He's rooted in history. Ma'agolah Asher Glatam Yichanya Melech Yudah. But it's a tragic history. It's a history of Jewish exile. Asher Ne'eglah Nebuchad Netzar Melech Bavel. And you have that whole piece. You have, by the way, we read in Perek Aleph, V'kelim Mikelim Shonim, also in a sad sort of voice. And who's Esther? Right? And then it continues and says, right, Vayihi Omein Et Hadassa, right, it's not here, right, Vayihi Omein Et Esther, right, Hadassa, Esther Bat Dodo, and so on. Right, she, Pshuto Shel Mikra, Pashtos, who's she? She's just the niece. Now you have this whole notion, this whole set of midrashim, it's a separate shir on their marriage and where that comes from. I actually think it goes to her. It's an odd. It doesn't seem to read. I think it might go to this issue of agency and equality and kind of be playing all these themes, but that's just a guess. But either way, Mordechai is the primary character, and she's just along for the ride. And not only is she along for the ride, she gets taken into the harem. She gets, she's selected. They don't really have a choice in this. And then she is silent, I assume appropriately so. In other words, she understood, presumably. I don't think she was ashamed of her nationality. There's no reason to think that. She understood that despite the apparently liberal policies in this kingdom, it would be unwise to unnecessarily give away her national identity. Even if that was the liberal policy, the sympathy from the populace, from the masses, the anti-Semitism that rises all too quickly to the fore as soon as Haman makes his decree, I think gives clear justification for this. So I don't think in Perek Bet Pasuk Yud, when it says that Lohigida Esther et Amaviet Molataki Mordechai Tziva Le'asher Lo Tagid, she did not tell. I think this was wisdom. I think this was not embarrassment, God forbid, and it's not passivity. It's actually quite shrewd. But note, what motivates her to make this decision? Right? Because she was so instructed by Uncle Mordechai. Right? He's calling the shots. She's just following the rules at this point.
I'm trying to remember how she was conscripted. Was it a voluntary or involuntary?
Yeah, no, I don't think there's anything.
Not that she was chosen, but how did the lineup of women happen?
So they sent out these letters and basically you were summoned. You were summoned to the harem and the king got to try you out. It's pretty clear that, I use that intentionally. In other words, it's pretty clear that it wasn't just to see the beauty of the girls. Right? It's pretty, I don't want to, again, burst any bubbles, but let's be honest. I think the Mefarshim say, and it's pretty clear that...
But whoever summoned them brought them in and chose them. Like, they were not voluntarily.
We don't know how they decided, but it sounds like it was a royal decree that went around to many, many, many households.
It was a beauty pageant. Yeah, I know, but usually beauty pageants are voluntary. You know,
not in ancient Persia they were. Not in queen selection, circa 4.
So it was understood that all the young women had to show up for the beauty.
That's what it seems, right? And then they had their 6 months and their 6 months.
They might have thought of it as a privilege.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah, I think well said. And right, and imagine if it is a poor family, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and so on and so forth. Right, just look at Cinderella. Okay. Right, now, what's interesting as well is that in Bet Tetvav, on the next source, that's on the top of page 3, source 9, Uvagia Torah Esther bar Avichai Odor Mordechai, right, so again, it's Esther, but this is her lineage. Asher lokach lo levat, right, so you didn't forget, right, secondary character. Lo miksha devar, whatever you say, right? Now, again, maybe shrewd, maybe she doesn't want to draw attention to herself, but the bottom line is she's a passive character. And the bottom line is, right, she's taking her instructions from or cue from Mordechai, and that's how she's introduced. And then it repeats, I think, textually, it's perhaps even unnecessarily. Mm-hmm. At the end of this chapter, it says, again, Ein Esther Magedet Mo'ataviyatama Kasher Tziva Aleha Mordechai. And I think you kind of knew that already. And if you could take a look at the whole parak and tell me if you think that there's a specific impetus for repeating it. But I think it's pretty clear. And it's almost as if to reemphasize the context, but also, again, that she is perhaps shrewdly, but ultimately she's not putting her identity forward on the basis of Mordechai, right? If you missed it the first 10 times, right? Okay? She obeyed Mordechai's bidding as she had done when she was under his tutelage. And again, I want to be crystal clear. I don't think Mordechai is doing anything wrong whatsoever, right? And Esther, I think also, I'm not being critical at all. If she was orphaned and she was taken in by Mordechai, this is what we would expect, right? But at some point, right, if she's going to come to the... Right, to come to the salvation of her people, if this story is not only about God operating behind the scenes, but about Esther's own religious and personal development, then there's something else that has to happen.
That's always, you know, been a little mysterious to me. I mean, she was taken. Mordechai's hanging out at the palace every day asking about her.
Yeah.
How did this remain a secret?
Right. Maybe, by the way, it's a good point. Maybe that's why it's repeated, because this is also right before it describes that. So I actually wonder if it's like almost reiterating that somehow they managed to do this. It's not clear that Mordechai, remember, was dressed in royal clothing, and it's not clear how widely Mordechai's own identity was or was not known. I'm thinking aloud, I don't know. And remember, they had a secret emissary, so it's not, they somehow, and he was picking up secrets, so clearly he was quite savvy at this, yeah. Right? I mean, he's a court Jew in his own right, although in a different, right? So, I think there's a shrewdness that both of them possess that we see throughout the story. But it is interesting.
Maybe she's just following his example in a certain way.
Yeah.
Comes out only when he doesn't bow.
That's exactly right. Well, that's interesting. So the question is Mordechai himself, and there's a whole other shear again of it's Mordechai made the right decision or wrong decision, by the way. Most think he made the right decision, but it's not 100% clear. And also, but more than that, what motivated Mordechai to do this, right? And he's putting his whole people in danger, and that's a whole piece. But clearly Mordechai steps forward. And the theme, we're not going to read these psukim, but the theme of nationhood is clearly present as well, right? Gimel Dalet, as they said, spoke to Mordechai every single day, right? The servant said, well, why don't you listen to bow to Haman? Velo shema alihem, he doesn't listen. Ve'agidu lehaman, ha'yirodi yamdu d'rei Mordechai. And now, ki gid lahem asher yehudi, now we know at least, right? Ki gid lahem asher yehudi, he Haman knew, right? Maybe it was a secret, maybe it wasn't, but Haman told them that he was a Yehudi, so that emphasis there as well. And then Pasuk Vav, somehow Haman makes the jump from, right? This is that anti-Semitic mm-hmm. move. Well, I don't like this Jew, right? This Jid, right? So what do? Right? So I intend for genocide against all of them. It's Mordechai, Vayvakesh Haman Lashmedet. Kol HaYudim Asher B'chol Achara Chashverosh Mordechai, right? And it's against the entire nation. And I think and that's his arguments, of course, to Achashverosh. Vayomer Haman Pasuk Cher, Lamachashverosh, Yeshno Amechar. And they are different. They don't follow the rules. And so you shouldn't, again, the question of nationhood, I think, is stressed here. The other nations, the policy of the Persian monarch vis-a-vis, or emperor vis-a-vis the different nations, and the nationhood of the Jewish people, and the jump of Haman as well, I think is all part of what's happening here. Now, we turn to Perek Dalet, and here, of course, Mordechai wears the sackcloth. Esther hears the news. She's very upset. She tries to get Mordechai to come to the palace gates. In order to do so, he has to dress up in royal clothing, not in sackcloth. He initially refuses. Finally, she gets him to come, and she's going to pray for the Jewish people, right? Or beseech him, rather, for the Jewish people, and that's in Dalet Chet. And if you jump to the next page, I'm on page 5 now, right? We come to the critical turning point. And she says, look, I can't do this. Anyone who goes in is going to die, right? To the Chatzer HaPnimi. And Mordechai sends the message to Esther in verse 13, Pasuk Yud Gimel Perek Dalet. Mysterious, but I think pivotal psukim in understanding the story. And here's where I think things come to a head, and here's, I think, the pivot in many ways of the Megillah. Vayomer Mordechai la'ashiv el Esther. Mordechai, what's his argument to Esther to convince her to step forward? So first of all, he says, Al tadami v'nav sheikh li malepit ha-melech mikol ha-yehudim. Don't imagine that you are going to escape the fate of your fellow Jews. Right? In other words, your fate is inextricably bound up with those of your fellow Jews. There's no way out. If you think that your personal identity is in any way separable from your national identity, you've got another thing coming to you. You don't understand how this works. So Mordechai makes the argument for the unification, basically, of personal identity and national identity. Recognize who you are. You are a Yehudi. You have no choice in the matter. It's what Rav Soloveitchik called the covenant of fate, as opposed to the covenant of destiny. We all, that was post-Holocaust, right? But we all suffer together. If there's a decree against the Jewish people, so that's part of what it means. It's not all of what it means to be a Jew, but certainly for 2,000 years it has been on fortunately and essentially starting point for much of our experience. And then he adds, he's not done. And this is really remarkable. If you remain silent, right, we spoke about finding your voice. If you, I would suggest, continue to remain passive. If you continue to not step forward and take the risk and find your own voice, some would suggest in the wake of some sort of either trauma or challenging experiences, right, or a complicated experience, she was brought to the harem, right, and she was the one who was chosen. Maybe she felt fortunate, but she was also essentially forced to be with the king, right? So, I mean, there's the whole psychological piece. And she was, if she was an orphan, if she was orphaned, there's a whole other piece there, right, in terms of her ability to find her own voice. And even though she had a support structure from Mordechai, then we're sure psychologically would have been essential to her success, still you have an orphaned young lady who was just demanded to come and to be with a king who had previously and was presently essentially sexually mistreating these young women. Can imagine that it's difficult for, we don't even know her age, for her to find her voice. But if you continue to remain silent this time, and this is the most remarkable thing, he says not that we're all going to die. Now he says, we'll be all right. Right? He said, yeah, but you're done.
Why is that?
Yeah, good question. Why is that? What do you guys think? What? Why is that? Right? I think that I assume that whatever power, sway Haman had over the people and the empire at large, he was dependent upon the masses to go to war, right, to carry that out. But anyone is in the inner circle, Haman has, you know, is directly exposed. And Haman himself can put the machinations in place to deal with it as he wishes. Yeah, so that's my gut. My gut is that Haman had intended ill for all the Jews, but even if he couldn't carry it out en masse, but there could be a limited amount of Jews. And we've seen that too in Jewish history.
It's disturbing. On the one hand, one can guess that Mordechai might be interested in seeing if Esther has become corrupt in the palace. But this shows an extraordinary lack of faith in Esther.
Mm-hmm.
It's very offensive. He says, do you think you're going to get that you're not going to be killed with us?
100%.
What gives him the even clues that she might behave that way? One might have started, one might have thought that he would start with, we're in a tough situation. Mm-hmm. Who knows that perhaps you have attained your world position for such a crisis. Start with that.
Yeah, 100%. It's a great question. And I've wondered about it myself. Right?
But who's expressing the fear of taking action.
Right.
So
addressing
that.
And I think it's only understood in light of what we've seen, which is not to say it's not necessarily a criticism of Esther.
Right.
Right? This young poor orphan, everything that we've seen, etc. Well, what else would you expect from her? But the point is that this is, right, our national future, right? Our future is at stake. Your future is at stake. If you want to, if you have someone who's active, sometimes if we want someone to move from a state of passivity to a state of activity, it requires that we shake someone up, that there be an intervention. And I think that in this moment of crisis, he felt that the only way to, you know, to energize or to bring out those inner, or to allow her to manifest those inner qualities, was to say, look, this is a do or die moment. This is revolutionary change rather than evolutionary change, because that's what this historic moment demands. And to Esther's great credit, of course, she does rise to the occasion. That's what's really remarkable. So, you know, I think we often think of our own or people's development as happening, you know, over the course of time. And I think for Esther, there's that light bulb moment. There's a wake-up call. And I think that that's a different kind of religious growth. There's a beautiful passage at the beginning where Tzadok HaKohen was one of the great Hasidic Rebbes, lived from 1823 to 1900. Fascinating life story, because he actually started off as a misnaged, as a litvak, as an anti-Chassid. Whoa. And then he was actually so enamored by the Hasidic tradition that he moved over, but he brought many of his rabbinic studies and so on and so forth, and those other inclinations into his Hasidic writings. One of his classic works is entitled Sidkas HaTzadik, The Righteousness. The Righteousness, and he opens, the first passage there is very striking. He draws on the holiday of Pesach there, and he says that the idea of chipazon, of rushing into something, he says the beginning of entry into Avodat Hashem is b'chipazon. It's very interesting. He says, and then you chill, right? Right? In other words, says, like, sometimes we just need to throw ourselves into something. We're not sure. We're like Nachshon Ben Aminadav at the, right? He was standing at the sea, didn't know whether or not to jump into the sea, according to the Midrash, so that the sea would split for the entire people, the Amsof, and you just got to jump in. Sometimes just needs to be b'chipazon. And I think of this as a moment, as a revolutionary rather than evolutionary moment on the part of Esther, and then all of a sudden she springs into action. And I think what's so powerful to me, though, is not only does she find her voice, but she finds her voice by locating herself within her community. And I think this is the point that sometimes is overlooked. Sometimes we talk about the development of Esther from passive to active. Sometimes we talk about the idea of the notion of the Jewish people and peoplehood and sending Mishloach Manot to the people and, you know, and so on and so forth. But I think what's so powerful about the Megillah is that for Esther, they happen at the same time. For Esther, finding her own voice is almost synonymous with, or is concurrent with, her ability to see herself as a member of nationhood. And I think it's very interesting. In 2018, we think of what does it mean to find myself? And we talk about finding people, I mean, just culturally, we talk about finding ourselves by looking within, not necessarily by looking at one's roots or one's background and so on and so forth. And I think Megillat Esther makes the opposite argument. If you want resilience to overcome trauma, and if you want to find your voice, anchoring oneself in a tradition, in a nation, in a people, and that doesn't mean I'm subsumed under that. I'm not talking about communism, right? We're talking about I have a unique flavor. I have my own place, my own voice within that larger family and tradition. That's how Esther finds her identity. I think it's a very powerful model for, and I think it's consistent with the psychological research as well. And I think Esther beat the psychologists to it, just because the psychologists didn't exist, by just a few thousand years. And I think there's something absolutely ingenious that's happening here between the lines about an orphan girl who locates herself, finds her own identity through through identifying with her entire nation. Solidarity. Sorry?
Bechipazon. What's the
word? Oh, I'm sorry. Speedily. You know, the Jews left quickly. They didn't have time to bake the, you know, to bake bread. They had the matzahs. And so it says that they left very hastily. Actually, we don't usually, this is not the traditional text, but if you take a look at Rambam's text of the Haggadah, it actually says that the Jews left Egypt hastily. And then goes into Halach Ma'anya. Bivihilu, it's in Aramaic. Bivihilu yatsanu mimitzrayim. We left quickly. And then it goes into the whole story about of the Haggadah. If you're interested in seeing at least the national solidarity piece, I gave you one of my favorite sichot from Rav Lichtenstein. You can read it. We're not going to read it together, but I urge it to your attention. And you can take a look online and find the entire thing. Just go on the Yeshivat Har Tzion's virtual Beit Midrash. You have a link there as well. And you can find that. But I think what's fascinating is that the notion, the themes of nationhood and agency, or moving from object to subject, continue to manifest themselves throughout. And I'll just give a few examples as we move to close. In source 14, even Haman's wife, right? Even Haman's wife, right? Vayisaber Haman zeresh ishto l'chol avagdi asher karahu, vayamru lo chachama v'zeresh ishto. Right? Someone pointed out, initially he says to his friends, and then they see that Haman's starting to lose his standing. So all of a sudden they're not his friends, they're just his advisors. Like they're distancing themselves, you know? Like we call that those who follow sports front runners, right? Your fair-weathered friends, right? I was you know what? Scholarly distance here, right? It's no longer successful. And she says, oh, wait, Ophi is from the Jews? Yeah, you got no choice. I forgot. I didn't realize that. You didn't tell me he's a Yehudi. Yeah, you've got no chance with those people, right? I mean, they're a resilient bunch. They're an eternal people. This is overlooked. This is one of the most important, beautiful, and inspiring psukim in the whole Megillah. The secret to Jewish eternity, right? That was formulated by none other than the wife of Haman. I mean, that's right. Mizera Yehudim, Mordechai Shechilot, and Pol Lefanav, Lo Tuchalo, right? If he's from Jewish stock, you're done. Kinefolti Pol Lefanav, right? It's over, right? Just.
I never know if this was a positive thing to say or a negative thing to say about the Jewish stock.
About the Jewish
stock. You know, they control everything, or...
No, I didn't take it as anti-Semitic. I didn't take it as, you know, protocols, rise elders. I took it as like, you know, like this is a people, like this has been tried before and it hasn't happened. I mean, look at them. For God's sake, their temple was destroyed and they're still here. You know, like they knew, people knew this is a very, these are famous international events. And I think that the sense that the Jews had, and there were marauders, there were during the first temple period, I mean, they warred against themselves, right? And then they somehow, and then after all of this, there were revolts and they were put down and the Jews were exiled in multiple waves, 100 years before the destruction of the temple, and then 18 years, and then again, there were still Jews somehow surviving in Yerushalayim and in Persia and in, you know, off in Babylonia, and she gets it. And it's nationhood. She sees the nationhood. And I think that continues. And all of a sudden, again, not just Mordechai, but Esther has a voice. And the whole story that we don't have time to go through, I wasn't planning to, the whole story about the parties, right? That is also a shrewd, ingenious plot. And that is also, frankly, I don't mean to overplay it here, but that's also sexual in nature. Because if you read it carefully, and Rashi says this explicitly as well, the insinuation that she makes is that Haman is trying to seduce her, the queen. And that's very clear, right? And that's very much the story. And the way that she presents the argument, when she says, Haman's after me, and then she says, and how can I see Zayin Vav, Ki Chachan, page 7, toward the top, I can barely see the destruction of my kindred. Esther very clearly now has come to fully identify with her people. So there's this pivot, there's this transition, and now she's the one, the argument she's making head on without any compunctions whatsoever is that she says, right, she says, I'm going to stand with my people. And now it's not just Esther who has that agency, who found her voice, but even others are starting to see, oh, it's the Jewish nation, it's the Jewish people. Maybe this is not going to be so easy. And then, by the way, it says, I didn't give you this pasuk, but in Perek Tet, I'm jumping obviously a number of prakim, Sukim Perek Tet Pasuk Aleph, it actually says that many of the nations, of the people of the nations, mityahadim, mm-hmm. which either means that they had sympathy for the Jews, or it means that they actually sought to or did convert. Okay, so woe, Jewish pride is now, right, is now skyrocketing. It's like post Six-Day War over here. And you have all, right, and you have all of that. And I think it helps us to resolve Perek Tet Pasuk that, you know, there's this curiosity. You know, just the genocidal decree. And then the king finally rescinds the decree, and then the enemies go out to fight the Jews anyway. So you find the latent anti-Semitism, and it says, and the Jews were successful in defending themselves. They gathered together, and no one stood before them. The fear had fallen upon the nation. And the question so he's asked is, what, the Jews weren't going to fight for themselves beforehand? Like, what do we need the king's decree for, right? They're ultimately successful, and I think that the answer is psychological. It's about self-pride. The other nations are afraid. The Jews feel a restored sense of pride. People want to join. They're cool, right? They're in, right? They won the tournament, right? Yeshiva University Maccabees just won their tournament or Division III. They're not playing on Shabbat, and they're there. You can go online. You can see the NCAA Tier 3 tournament. They're in. So, right? The Lahavdil many, many times over. They were victorious, as it were, but here in a much more serious sense and existential sense. And so I think it's about Jewish pride. I think it's Esther, her own sense of Jewish pride now spills over and has an effect. There's fear from the nations. The Jewish feel that sense of swelling. And I think this also now, through chapter 10, explains the Mishloach Manot Matanot Levyonim, because I think now what we see is the whole story of the Megillah from beginning to end is about agency, and it's about agency as a member of a nation, of nationhood, and about nationhood, and about that those are inextricably bound. So what do? We celebrate that sense of that we find ourselves as individuals, as part of a community, by distributing Mishloach Manot. And frankly, more importantly, I give my shout out for Matanot Le'Avyonim. Mishloach Manot are very important, but the halacha is that Matanot Le'Avyonim are even more important. So, but all of these are important, and they create nationhood. And I think it's about the Jews echoing Esther's own journey, and they say, "No, we too have found our agency. We found our own voice as members of a larger community." And I think this ultimately is the story. If you are interested, I gave you one of my favorite New York Times articles ever. It's an excerpt. You can look this up online. There are you get 10 free. You get 10 free a month. So this is published back in 2013, and it's called The Stories That Bind Us by Bruce Feiler, and it's basically about how people find resilience in family narratives, and there's a lot there, and it's absolutely fascinating. There's a lot of wisdom in that article. I strongly recommend it to you. How do you overcome trauma? I think Esther overcomes trauma, but clearly rootedness in a family and rootedness in a story that's compelling and that resonates with me is what helps me to overcome trauma, we've found, and the research has found, and find my own voice, my own identity. And I think that's exactly very much the story of Esther. So in sum, I think Esther really is, it's about two stories that are really one and the same. It's not only a story about Esther finding her voice, right? Not only about God behind the scenes, but about the protagonist and Esther finding her own voice. And it's not only about the Jewish nation finding pride, but I think those are the same story. Those are one and the same. And I think it's a very powerful and beautiful lesson that if we seek to think critically to overcome the challenges in our lives and to find our own voice in our own experiences, that happens in a context of community. That is Jewish wisdom. I think it's collective wisdom now. It's not popularly touted, I think. It's not part of our culture in the way that I think it ought to be. I think it's one of the great challenges of our society today. But I think that Esther Megillat Esther saw this lesson and shared it with the world well over 2,000 years ago. And I think it's a message that deserves to continue to be shared. I wish everyone a Freilich in Purim. It should be a time of Jewish unity. And that should be a time of real joy for us, for the entire community. And that we should all find our voices in context of community.